Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
I still have a dream. It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream.
Never give in. Never, never, never. In nothing, great or small, large or petty, never give in except to convictions of honor and good sense.
Welcome to the On Point Podcast. This is your host, Luke Alshoff, a first year hailing from Region 8 based in NCFCA. This is a weekly podcast where I'll have a guest on the show and cover something in speech or debate.
And now a word from our sponsors.
Since its founding in 2011, the online debate has hosted over 2,000 registrations and facilitated nearly 3 million in scholarships from its sponsors. Ziggy offers online seasonal tournaments for preseason prep in the fall and midseason prep in the spring. These opportunities give you unrivaled access to face out-of-region competition, cases, and arguments with qualified judges all season long. In just under 3 weeks, Ziggy is hosting their first-ever live-paced national championship, which will consist of full preliminary rounds and out-rounds. Sign up now by going to ziggyonlinedebate.com and receive early bird pricing. You can also use promo code ONPOINT to receive 10% off your registration. Among notable sponsors, Howard Payne University is giving away $60,000 scholarships for all winners and runner-ups, and $56,000 scholarships for all third and fourth place teams. Whether you need a head start into your nationals campaign or desire more debating opportunities, the Ziggy National Championship is just for you. I hope you enjoy this episode. Hello and welcome back to another episode. Today I'm joined by Nathan Chen. Now, Nathan Chen has been competing in the NCFCA for 3 years and has earned several accomplishments along the way. Most notably, he won regionals in 2021 for team policy, got second at the fourth online qualifier in 2021, and ranked 8th at nationals with a fourth place speaker award. This year, he has won 3 first place speaker awards, got second place at the online mixer for LD, first at an all-region qualifier, and won LD for the recent online national open. I'm so glad you could join me today, Nathan.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Great. So let's talk a little bit about your experiences. So I just talked to you right before we began, and this is your sophomore year, correct?
Yeah, my sophomore year.
So what have you learned in these like past 3 years? Do you think that you were just naturally talented, or did you actually put in a lot of effort to become how you are now?
It was definitely a lot of hard work, and a lot of it is definitely credited to my parents and the conversations I've been able to have with them. I don't think I'm naturally talented, actually. Personally, I'm a huge introvert, so every time I go up there to speak, it's actually quite scary for me. But yeah, it's definitely a lot of hard work and figuring out the different arguments and TP, a lot of different research.
For sure. So what has been your favorite? You've tried at TP and LD, so what would you say is your favorite style of debate?
Yeah, so personally, I'm a big fan of TP just because of it's a little bit more down-to-earth and concrete. LD, you get into more subjective and abstract realms. So I like TP for its more of its simplicity and a little bit, or it being a little bit more objective.
Right. So in these past 3 years, what has motivated you to become better? What has pushed you to try to learn more and become the best debater that you could be? So what was your motivation behind this? It's a really big question, I know, but I'm interested to hear your take.
Yeah, so I think what motivates me the most probably, aside from I'm just very competitive, I think one thing that's really motivated me is actually when I don't do as well as I would like in previous qualifiers or tournaments at the start of the year, and then that kind of gives me enough feel for the rest of the year wanting to do better. So I guess it kind of does just fall back to a competitive nature.
Yeah. And I think that's a characteristic that most people in NCFCA share, or at least the people who do.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
It's the competitive nature that drives some to keep practicing and keep becoming better. And even throughout all different types of competitive sports, it's just competitiveness that makes people strive to become better and better. So that's definitely a really good characteristic to have if you want to be good at NCFCA.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
So throughout this year, the resolution, at least how I've looked at it in Lincoln Douglas, which is the individual's right to property ought to be valued above the economic interests of the community. This resolution throughout the year, it, to me, it almost looks like it's kind of evolved into something different than it was at the start of the year. So at the start of this year, for example, negative was always pictured as this communist, very bad thing that no one wants because we all like our rights, you know? So I think that as the year has moved on, people have realized that it's much more than that. And there's actually a good amount of significance to the negative side rather than the actually like the affirmative. So what's your take on how the resolution has shifted throughout this year? And do you think it's a good shift? Where do you side with the resolution?
So at the very least in my region, the shift in, I suppose, the meta, you could call it, hasn't really gone super far. We're kind of still at that level where we're still characterizing negative in those darker lights. I think across the board, and I think we saw this at the National Open a little bit too, negative is definitely being characterized a bit more in the light. And I think people are realizing that NCFCA wouldn't really want one side of the resolution to just be tilted as the superior side. So I think that's an important way that I think people might be realizing that the negative is not so bad, because no negative is going to want to or have to argue something that's immoral. I'm not too sure how to answer the question of how it's shifted, because I think the metagame kind of varies across different regions. But I think generally we're seeing kind of a turnover to a negative shift, as in the negative is gaining a little bit more of an advantage compared to the affirmative bias that we had in the early season.
Absolutely. I think the way that I've seen it is that at the start of this season, people looked at both sides and they tried to determine which one was more intrinsically valuable. But now it's shifted more towards which one is more valuable in a situation of conflict. So in my opinion, that's how it's sort of shifted to now which one should stand when one right harms the community or when one right harms the economy. In which instance should the either side prevail? And that's kind of like what I think about how the resolution has changed up till now.
Yeah.
So have you looked at next year's resolutions that they've offered?
Yes, I've mainly looked at the LD ones, not so much the TP ones, however.
Yeah. Well, would you mind sharing your thoughts on the resolutions a little bit? I'll bring them up really quickly. So the first resolution is rationalism should be valued above empiricism. And the second one is ongoing law enforcement investigations and judicial proceedings should not be published. And the third one is stability is more important than turnover in government. So as you said, you've looked through these. Which one is your favorite? Which one do you think would be the best LD-ish resolution for next year? And why is that?
Yeah, so I think I would have to kind of break this down on like a competitive like framework and then a personal one. So personally, I like the rationalism versus empiricism one. I think it's really intellectually, like it's quite interesting to see those two various ideas and how they interact. But competitively, I think the best option is actually the second one about government investigations and whether they should be published. And I think I have a bit of a nuanced view, because at least in my region, people like the rationalism versus empiricism one. But my take on that is I don't think it's the best resolution for a few reasons. The first one is just the complex nature and the really abstract nature of even just the words rationalism and empiricism. For a community judge, it's going to be pretty intimidating. And I mean, for a lot of novices, I think it's going to be hard to grasp those concepts. And on a more logical side as well, I think it's kind of hard to find an actual conflict, because to a certain degree, I think you're under, by valuing one position like rationalism above empiricism, you're necessarily undervaluing that same position, because empiricism is all about like the concrete world and in rationalism all about the abstract world. So if you undervalue one of those principles, because I'm assuming it should be in conflict, if you undervalue a principle like rationalism for the sake of empiricism, well, because they're so interdependent, they rely on each other a lot, it's kind of a contradiction to value one above the other because they're so intrinsically linked. So I think finding a conflict that uniquely is mutually exclusive is going to be almost impossible. And I think there is a good article on this resolution too that talks about it. I think it's by Noah McKay, but he does a good analysis of both of them. And one of the things he knows, I think it's pretty interesting, is that you're probably not going to find a philosopher who's a pure rationalist. I think you're going to find more of them on the empiricist side. So there might be a tilt in that sense as well. But for the last resolution, the one about stability over turnover in government, I think this one is particularly disadvantageous for the ones who talk about government stability, because I think most people would really just argue, well, the American Revolution and just human nature shows us that people can be bad and that we need checks on government. So arguing that, I think, falls a little bit short of a goal of a balanced resolution, just because I'm pretty sure there's a pretty strong advantage to the side of government turnover.
Yeah, so in resolution two, you said that was your probably like the best one because it's most competitive. But to me, this one looks the least LD-ish out of all of them. To me, ongoing law enforcement investigations and judicial proceedings should not be published. That just sticks out as a very, not very TP, but not very LD as well. So what do you think sticks out about this? What values do you think could be brought up from this?
So to the extent of values, I haven't gone that far in thinking about it, but I definitely think you could just have like general ideas like justice, I think is still applicable, or just ideas like the right to privacy and whatnot. But I think the reason why I see it, I understand how you see it as TP-ish resolution as well as kind of like an LD, like a pseudo in between. And I completely agree. It really does sound like that. I think the reason why I find it like the most competitively balanced among the three is just because arguably it's the least of the three worst choices, or it's not the worst choice. I don't really like any of the resolutions this year. So I think number two will give us the most balance here, because the first one, you have the blatant problems of it being pretty complicated and the logical problem of it not really being possible. And for the stability and turnover, you're not really going to see, I think, a lot of affirmative wins, just because most people, because we live in America, are going to be all for government checks and balances on turnovers and whatnot. And so the second one, although it is a little bit more TP-ish in the way it's worded, I think it's the most balanced, because I think there is a side or a more common ground to be made on both sides, which makes it a little bit more competitively balanced than the other two.
Yeah. Well, that was a really good take on it, and I'm glad I could pick your thoughts on that. But let's kind of drive back towards what we're going to be discussing today, which is that of cross-examination. And I'm really excited about this topic because, to me, cross-examination is such an interesting little world of its own. And what would you say cross-examination, how significant is it to the round?
Yeah, so I definitely think cross-examination is incredibly important to the round. I think rounds are made in cross-examination, and rounds can be lost in cross-examination. And personally, in my ballots, a lot of my rounds actually have been won in cross-examination, in just a way that we can interact with the other opponent and then kind of have us agree on common ground, I think is important, but also point out various holes in their cases and then contrast that immediately with the opponent. I think judges see that definitely as an important part to the round.
Yeah. So when you're going into cross-examination, what should be the goal that you have in mind? What's the purpose of cross-examination?
I think the purpose of cross-examination is to probably to like set up a point. I know a lot of people have strong opinions about this and say, well, cross-ex should never be to make a point. And I somewhat agree with that. I understand that, you know, it's meant to be a questioning period and not a time to just stand there and add 3 minutes to whatever speech you're talking about. But I think primarily it should be a place to set up points, but you can kind of imply points in cross-examination as well.
Right. So just to review, you're saying that like the goal of cross-examination is to kind of like set up the rest of your speeches. Is that right?
Yeah, to set up the points that you have in your next speeches.
Right. And with CrossX, I feel like, to me, when I first began, since this is my first year, for cross-examination, it was just a time that I had to ask a lot of questions. And for me, when I first began, LD and all these speeches that we had, to me, I just had to fill up every single time slot. And for cross-examination, do you think that's the same, or should you be a bit more savvier with the questions that you're asking over trying to fill up the time?
Yeah, so I think that's pretty context specific. And I think it also depends on the style. So for TP specifically, in CrossX, if you need more prep time, I mean, it's a good use of time to just ask a ton of clarifying questions so that your partner just has the extra 3 minutes. But in LD specifically, we're not confronted with that same scenario. I think I would prioritize asking a better question over trying to fill in the time, because I don't really think it's going to be much of an impact. If you have 30 seconds left, but you don't have any good questions left, I think you should just end it there and just sit down when you need to, because if you're flailing around trying to think of different questions and you're probably not going to think of a amazing question, then I think it will look better in front of the judge, and the contrast will be better between you and your opponent if you just choose to end the cross-examination on a good note rather than a scramble around for a few different questions.
Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree. And kind of on that note, have you ever heard of the saying, there's no such thing as a dumb question?
Oh, yeah.
Do you think that applies to cross-examination as well?
So, I think it kind of does, and at the same time, it kind of doesn't, in the sense that, you know, again, I think it goes back to different styles. For TP, I don't really think there's a such thing as a dumb question, because there's always questions you can ask that buys you prep time, and that's kind of enough of a cause-benefit analysis to say that, you know, I can keep on asking you about your definitions and your plan, because a lot of it is detail-specific. But if we shift over back to LD, I think there can definitely be parts of CrossX where you can ask something that you shouldn't have. For instance, if I ask a really open-ended question about your case that I didn't mean to, then you can use that time to just expand and build up your case, even though it is my cross-examination. So I think there can be times in which questions shouldn't be asked, and there are questions that should and shouldn't be asked. So, I mean, if we're talking about clarifying questions, there really isn't too many of those. But a lot of the times when you're trying to make a point, there can be a case where you ask something that you shouldn't, and then your opponent can exploit that.
Yeah. And you brought up how you can ask like a really open-ended question, and your opponent can just take that and just go down their entire case and regurgitate points that they already brought up. So if you're on the receiving end of a question like that, should you go ahead and do that?
So I think it's pretty context-specific again, but I think definitely if you're met with an open-ended question, you have an opportunity to expand and to build up on your case, I think you should take it. But just a nuance is, you don't want to be too overpowering in the cross-examination takeover, because if you do that, I mean, judges will notice, hey, I mean, shouldn't he have more time to ask questions? So I think definitely take the opportunity, but I guess just do it with a bit of grace as well.
Right. So there should absolutely be like a mix of questions that are brisk and questions that are almost in a sense like you're rambling on to fill up a little bit of time, but not to the sense that the judge notices that you're trying to waste your opponent's time, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Great. So for you personally, do you have a similar layout in cross-examination that you used consistently throughout different debates?
Yeah, but for this year, I would always have a set of prescribed questions that I would ask in the beginning of the cross-examination just to establish a bunch of common ground. Like, can we agree on that we're talking about, you know, values debate here, we're not talking about how things are implemented, types of questions like that. And then I would move on to the specific questions to my opponent's case. But I think it's definitely helpful to have a set of baseline questions that you can expand on, because although it may be apparent to you that these questions, I mean, everybody should agree on, your opponent might just disagree. And then that will definitely have an impact on how you refute and then how the debate goes further. So it's important to establish some common ground in a set of prescribed questions.
Absolutely. I think that's one of the most important parts of cross-examination is understanding what the common ground is. And that's one of the parts that you should spend at least some of your time in cross-examination developing. What is the common ground? What do you guys both believe in? And from that, you can determine what you guys don't both agree with. And that becomes like the conflict that you discuss later on. And for me, that's something I've always, sometimes I've kind of struggled with that, because if I didn't set the common ground, then later on, I would be assuming things about my opponent that I forgot to ask them in cross-examination. Even if it's like a really simple question, like, when do you limit rights? Because if I say something like, when do you limit rights? And in my later speech, if I didn't ask that, I would say, oh, they only limit rights, the negative. Negative only limits rights. The affirmative. The affirmative only limits rights when it harms other rights. But then the affirmative can come up and say, well, that's not true. So then it just goes all the way back to cross-examination, which is really important to understand what the common ground is between both sides.
Yeah, for sure.
So you mentioned that you do prescript some questions. Is there a significance to that? Is it a good idea to prescript some of your questions?
I think it is a good idea to prescript some questions. Definitely don't prescript all questions, because a lot of the cross-ex should be about your opponent's case, not just a set of questions that you talk about. But I think it is definitely advantageous, especially when there's an idea you want to come that you want to actually communicate to the judge, but the idea is a little bit more complex. So thinking through how you want to ask that set of questions just beforehand, entirely outside of the round, I think will give you a better question than off the cuff. So I think there is definitely value to having prescribed questions, and especially like you were saying, in establishing common ground, it's super important. So having a bunch of prescribed or prescripted questions that you can just ask in the beginning of cross-examination to establish that common ground, I definitely think is advantageous for, I think, the reasons that you listed as well.
Yeah. And you brought up previously when I asked you about your layout that you do have a set of prescripted questions for a clarification and finding out what the common ground is. So do you think that prescripted questions should be limited to just that, to clarifying something and having these basic ideas and trying to agree with your opponent on those things? Or should you also ask more wider questions that may or may not be dependent upon what your opponent's case is?
Yeah, I think when you're prescripting the questions, you should definitely shouldn't be limited to exclusively clarifying questions. I think when you can ask a really good question or a really good prescriptive set of questions about like a specific concept like taxes per se, that would be really good to have a prescriptive set of questions on, just because I think when we're talking about the idea of taxes, it gets a little convoluted, because there's a lot of different ways you can interpret it. There's a lot of different ways your opponent can go in and out of that series of questioning. But if you have a really solid framework in how you're going to ask the questions and get your idea across, I think it's particularly beneficial to you.
Yeah. So on that note, let me kind of present like a little hypothetical scenario, because this wouldn't really happen in a real round. But imagine you had the choice between, say, one killer question that, you know, like gets your opponent stumped, or it's a really hard question, or if you had a bunch of clarifying questions that may be a little bit on the weaker side, which do you think would be better?
I think, so just judging that question off of face value, I think the killer question would be the way to go, just because you can push that point across throughout the rest of the round. But if I'm going into the round and then I'm not really understanding at all what my opponent has just said, I think there are times in which I would take a lot of clarifying questions to really understand what he's trying to say before I introduce my counter arguments, as opposed to a killer argument, because it's not much help to me, a killer argument, if I don't really know what my opponent is saying.
Yeah. So in that scenario, it'd be like a case-by-case basis, depending upon your own understanding of what your opponent is saying. So if you do understand what your opponent is saying, in that scenario, you should try to focus on questions that may spark some conflict that your opponent may disagree on, that your opponent may even stumble upon. Those are the questions that you should try to get if you understand what your opponent is saying and you don't have that many common ground or clarification questions you have to ask, right?
Yeah, if I understand what my opponent is saying, I'll usually just ask a few clarifying questions just to make sure the judge is on the same ground as well. But the majority of the cross-ex is, like you said, focused on questions that are about the opponent's case in terms of arguments instead of just about clarifying things.
Right. And in cross-examination, I feel like for me, or at least in rounds that I have watched, it varies a lot depending upon who you're cross-examining. So depending upon who you're cross-examining, or just in general, does delivery style and how you articulate your words or the way that you actually say them, does that matter much in cross-examination?
Yeah, so I definitely think it does matter. I mean, it's pretty hard to measure that in terms of ballots because a lot of the times it's kind of like a unconscious judgment that we do when we take a look at delivery and whatnot. But I think one of the ways you can more easily measure in some of the ways that have appeared in ballots is in the way of asking questions. You don't want to be like completely in their face and just asking them a ton of questions because it makes you look like an aggressor and no judge really wants to vote for that because it's not appealing. So I think the way you deliver and the way you ask and sound in cross-examination definitely matters, as well as the specific choice of wording that you use for the question. Because if a really good a person who's responding to your questions catches on to like a specific word that they don't like that they think could be used against them, I think sometimes then they'll just disagree for the sake of that particular idea because they don't want to get the wrong idea across when responding.
Yeah, and for me, I just watched a round a week ago, and in this round, it had a senior guy cross-examining this little, very small, I would say maybe like an 8th or 9th grade girl, and in that scenario, it would definitely be much better for the man who's cross-examining her to be much more gentle and soft-spoken with his questions rather than having a very passionate and fiery approach, especially if you have like female judges, right?
Oh yeah, for sure. In my region, I think a year ago, basically the same situation. We had this one guy. He's basically a giant. He's like 6'7" or 6'9". He's huge. And then he's cross-examining this little girl who's, I don't know, like 5'2" or something. But the contrast is just huge. So he played it in such a way that it was a really gentle cross-examination. I think that comes across effectively because, again, if the contrast is that significant, just like physically, you definitely want to back off of being cross-ex.
Yeah. So in most scenarios, would you say that it's better to be calm and collected or passionate and outspoken in cross-examination?
In most cases, I think a calm, reasonable presentation is good, but I think there are situations that might call for having a more aggressive style of cross-examination. I mean, well, sometimes you do want to contrast like your opponent. If your opponent's being aggressive, being calm is better. But sometimes if there's a specific like topic that should be talked about with more, I suppose, passion and whatnot, then you should be a little bit more aggressive in that sense just because it's fitting to the type of question you're asking. But most of the time, I definitely think you're not going to be asking those type of emotional questions. Most of the time, you're just going to be asking simple questions, so you should come across as just calm and reasonable.
Right. And asking those calm and collected questions, is that something that most people have to develop, or is it something that should come naturally?
I think, yeah, it kind of depends on like the kind of personality you have. For me, personally, when I started off, I was pretty aggressive in cross-examination. And a lot of the ballots that I had, excuse me, didn't like the aggressive nature of my cross-ex. So I had to work pretty hard to make sure that my cross-examination became calmer and more reasonable. So I think it can come across naturally for people. If the person is just not super competitive, more laid back, then it will be easier to develop that style of questioning. But for some people like myself, that definitely takes time to actually develop that calmer style of questioning.
Yeah, and I actually watched your finals round because it was online for the online national open, and I noticed how you asked your questions in cross-examination, and it was just as you described it, very calm, very collected, sophisticated. You knew, it seemed as if you knew what you were asking before you said it, which was a dumb thing to say because of course you did. And
yeah, I hope so.
In that way, I could really tell how you worked on that calm and collected nature that you had in those questions. And you said that you ended up having to work on it because you were very passionate in your questions before. So what did you do to work on being much more calm and collected?
That's a pretty tough question, but I think one of the main things I did was it's not so much like of a technique thing as it really is just consciously telling yourself to be calmer and just making a very conscious, a very deliberate effort to be more, I suppose, yeah, just be more calm in cross-examination. One thing to probably remember is that, you know, it's just a debate round. It's just a high school debate round. It's not really going to have that much impact. So you don't need to be asking questions like your life depends on it. So there is definitely, and it even is advantageous to just ask calmer questions. So being more aggressive can be harmful in a lot of circumstances. So I think just that mentality definitely helped to cool down my cross-examination into way of it being more calm.
Yeah. And for me, I've experienced a lot of rounds in which people bring up like these illustrations, elaborate illustrations that they bring up in their cross-examinations. The thing is sometimes really strange, like, do you like pineapple on your pizza? And somehow they turn it into like a rights versus rights thing. And I'm like, how did you make that connection? But what are your thoughts on like these illustrations that people make to illustrate a point in cross-examination? Do you think it's worth it, or should people stick to much more just normal questions?
I haven't really seen too many of those, but when I have, I think one of the reasons, I mean, I don't want to like say that this is the reason why people are asking these questions, but I think at the very least, if I were to ask these kinds of questions, I think the reason why is primarily just to throw your opponent off a little bit. Like, why are we talking about pineapple and pizza? We're talking about rights and economic interests. I think it's primarily meant to throw you off your game a little bit. So I don't think it's super helpful. I mean, I suppose for certain, there are certain outlier judges who are like, yeah, I totally love those types of questions. But I think when you think of it from like an opportunity cost perspective, you could be asking the same question in a more layman terms than a more, you know, crazier pineapple on pizza terms to get your point across. And I think preferring that style of questioning is always better than the wacky, you know, surprising various types of questions.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you so much for having this interview with me, Nathan. And one final question before we end. Do you actually like pineapple on your pizza?
Personally, no, I don't like pineapple on pizza.
Okay, great. Well, thank you for these time that you could take and answering some questions that I had for you. And I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Of course. Take care.
You too.
Thanks for listening to this episode. If you have any comments, suggestions, questions, or just want to keep up to date, you can follow my Instagram at onpointpodcast_. Again, that's onpointpodcast_. Thanks for tuning in, and I'll see you in the next one.